So, does foreign aid just make things worse? Well, Peter Singer doesn't think so. Singer is one of the world's most influential and controversial philosophers. His book Animal Liberation helped launch the animal rights movement. His utilitarian arguments for abortion and euthanasia have infuriated many people, especially those with disabilities. Now Singer has turned his attention to poverty. In his book The Life You Can Save, he argues that virtually everyone in the developed world has a moral obligation to fight poverty. And he even has a chart outlining how much money we should give away. Steve Paulson recently caught up with Peter Singer.
Let me start with a very basic question. How many people around the world are now suffering from extreme poverty?
The most recent World Bank estimate is 1.4 billion people.
What percentage of the global population is that?
It's slightly under a quarter. It's perhaps between a fifth and a quarter, something of that sort. So it's a very significant portion, but on the other hand, we shouldn't feel doom and gloom because if you go back to the 1960s, it was 40% of the world's population. So we've made progress.
How is extreme poverty defined?
The World Bank defines it as not having enough income to securely provide for your basic needs or those of your dependents. That means not having enough to be sure that you'll get enough food all year round, probably not having safe drinking water, not being able to get any health care if your children get ill, even a very simple illness like diarrhea, which can be fatal if untreated in children, and not really being able to educate your children, again, depending on the circumstances. Generally, the World Bank calculates now that you need the purchasing power equivalent of $1.25 US per day.
So where do these very poor people live?
Well, a lot of people are surprised to hear that actually the largest number of people in extreme poverty are still in India, not in sub-Saharan Africa. Of course, India is a large country with a very large population, much larger than sub-Saharan Africa. Sub-Saharan Africa is the region that has the highest proportion of people in extreme poverty. But they also exist in many other parts of the world, in Southeast Asia, in Central Asia, in Latin America.
And what are the consequences for people who live in such dire straits? I mean, are you talking about people dying from malnutrition or are people dying from diseases that could be easily prevented?
Some of them will die from malnutrition, yes, but probably more will die because they've been weakened by malnutrition and so they can't resist diseases that otherwise they would be able to resist. And those diseases include diarrhea, which is estimated to kill about 2 million children every year. That's a disease that is both preventable if you can provide safe drinking water, you can largely prevent it, and really quite easily curable if you can get some kind of basic health care to the children who get it. In fact, the World Health Organization says that the treatment for childhood diarrhea costs about 30 cents.
Now, when I hear stories like this, I mean, it's tragic. I mean, especially when you hear about how diarrhea can kill so many people, how it does every year. But there's also a sense that extreme poverty is a problem we'll always have. It's intractable. There have always been situations like this. It seems like there always will be. Do you share that bleak assessment?
No, I think that's too bleak. Let me say that I think there will be relative poverty always. I don't think we'll ever, you know, all be equally prosperous. We'll have repressive governments, we'll have civil wars, we'll have droughts and floods and climate change maybe. All of these things may mean that some people at some times are in extreme poverty. But there doesn't have to be a billion people permanently living in extreme poverty. That's a situation that we could change. We could change quite dramatically.
You are a philosopher, and you are making the argument that virtually all of us in America have a moral obligation to give money to help reduce world poverty. Are you trying to guilt trip us?
No, I'm not really interested in producing guilt, certainly not for its own sake. I think that's not productive at all. But I would like Americans to think about their obligations to those in extreme poverty when we have something to spare. It may not be much, but you know, any American who thinks nothing of buying bottled water or a can of soda when there's safe water to drink that comes out of the tap has something to spare that these people in extreme poverty we were talking about would not dream of buying because they would be spending, you know, everything they need to live on, or they and their families need to live on for a day, on one drink which is not nourishing and unnecessary. So I think that we should realize how easy it would be for us to help others. And I'm urging that Americans do that because I really want them to make a difference.
So how much should we give?
Well, I've got a scale in the book, and also I've put it on a website that I've set up with the same title as the book, so thelifeyoucansave.com. And the good news is that for 90% of Americans, it's asking you to give 1% of your income only, which I think is something that is really quite affordable, let's say $500 if you're earning the average American income of $50,000. And it's only if you get into the top 10% of American taxpayers, which would mean you'd be earning $105,000 or above, that this goes up. It goes up initially to 5%, then if you're earning still more, to 10%, and eventually it goes up to a third. But it never gets higher than that. And so I think it's a realistic level of giving.
Now, there are also serious scholars and former aid workers who've wrestled with this whole question of aid. And some of them have concluded that it doesn't help. In fact, it may hurt. Foreign aid sometimes just lines the pockets of corrupt government officials, or it can create a culture of dependency. How do you respond to those criticisms?
Well, those criticisms are generally directed against government aid or World Bank aid. Some of those critics, the most recent one is Dambisa Moyo, and she specifically says in the opening pages of her book that she's not talking about non-government agencies. She's talking about governments and the World Bank. William Easterly, an economist, wrote a similar book a few years ago, and he also says that he's really talking about government aid. So I think the answer to this is to say yes. We must be really careful about the aid we give. We must be smart about the aid we give, make sure that it's going to the people who need it. You know, non-government agencies don't give to governments by and large. They give to grassroots organizations of villages or people in urban slums who are going to be able to receive the assistance that the money pays for.
Can you tell me some success stories of organizations that have worked, let's say, specifically in India or in sub-Saharan Africa that are really making some inroads on some of these problems that you've described?
Well, sure. I saw an Oxfam project myself, for example, a few years ago in Pune in India, which was helping women of the lowest class, the so-called untouchables, who were earning a very meager living on the city's garbage dump, basically combing through everything there and pulling out anything they could sell as recyclable. So pieces of plastic, pieces of metal, even plastic bags. They were pulling out rags, any of that. And they were taking them to dealers who bought those kinds of things. But, you know, because they were so low and they were women, they were getting very poor prices for what they were selling. They were subject to sexual harassment. And, of course, the work was, you know, just totally filthy. I went and saw them doing it. And, you know, other people in my group actually just stayed in the vehicle with the air conditioning on because they could not stand the stench. Now, the interesting thing about that project is that it helped the rag pickers, as they were called, to unite and therefore to get better prices, better bargaining power for what they were selling. It helped them approach the city council and suggest to residents of the better parts of the city that they should separate their recyclables when they put out the trash. And so the untouchable women could go into the apartment buildings and get it there without combing through the rubbish heap. And best of all, just around the time I got there, the women were saying to Oxfam, "You've been tremendous in helping us to get organized. We have a better way of living now. We understand a lot more. We're sending our children to school, which we couldn't do before. So thank you very much for that. And we don't need any more aid now because we've done that and we're out of that situation." So that's the kind of project that I think, you know, we really want to support, something that gets people onto their feet and enables them not to be dependent on aid but to say, we're okay now.
And what about the earlier problem that you were talking about, all these children in particular who are dying from diarrhea just because they don't have safe water to drink and inexpensive medications? Have there been some effective programs dealing with that?
Oh, yes. And again, you know, that's something that you can do personally. And I know someone who did. I mean, it takes a bit more than, you know, small amounts of money. But this is somebody who inherited some money from his father. He was He was a professional, wasn't rich, but he was quite comfortable, didn't think he needed more. So he looked around for what he could do, and he found that for about $10,000, he could hire a drilling rig that could drill a well for a village in Ethiopia, where previously the women of that village, because it culturally it's women who do this, had to walk an hour to a river, then fill a plastic container with water and carry that heavy container on their backs back to the village. That was all the water they had for the family for the day. And that water was not safe to drink because there were stock raising in the river and defecating in the river and polluting it. So they then had to boil, or they faced a dreadful choice, really. They either had to boil the water, which would use scarce fuel, which there wasn't much of in this area, or they risked their children getting diarrhea. And as we were saying, some of them would die from diarrhea. So this person I know spent the $10,000, brought the drill in, drilled for the well, got water, as they knew there was water under there, put in a very simple hand-operated pump, no machinery, motors, anything like that that could break down. And now they don't have to walk for water. They have safe water right there in the village. And the kids don't get diarrhea anymore. So, you know, I don't know how many lives he saved, but he certainly saved thousands of hours of work, of pretty meaningless work, and a lot of fuel being consumed by something that really doesn't cost more than a family might spend on a vacation abroad.
Peter Singer is a philosopher at Princeton University. He spoke with Steve Paulson about his book, The Life You Can Save. If you'd like to see Singer's list of recommended aid groups, go to our website at ttbook.org. Wow.